there was a group of documentary filmmakers who were fortunate enough during the pandemic to have followed around some really interesting people, none of them professionals. They were all retail traders, many of whom were trading for the first time, just really because markets were going crazy and there was not much else to do. And they happened to have hit upon some trading activity that made them overnight millionaires, and then in most cases, cost them everything, including in one case, a marriage. It's like an encapsulation of the fear and greed and like the whole behavioral experience of instant riches and then losses and the roller coaster.
Welcome to the Mittland Money Mindset. This is a podcast that's all about getting your mind right when it comes to all things money. In every episode, we go deep with engaging guests who provide tangible takeaways and a whole lot of joy along the way. I hope you enjoy these conversations as much as I enjoyed having them. Let's dive into today's show. I'm Larry Sprung, your host for the Mittland Money Mindset and founder and wealth advisor of Mittland Financial. Today's guest is Josh Brown, co-founder and CEO of Ritholtz Wealth Management. Josh Brown is a financial advisor, writer, content creator, TV personality, podcaster, investor, founder, and most importantly, a dad. He helped co-found Ritholtz Wealth Management, a New York City-based investment advisory firm managing over $4 billion for high net worth investors, corporate retirement plans, and foundations. Josh has documented his story and career within financial services through his blog, The Reform Broker, which is read by millions of investors, traders, and advisors around the world. I can recall reading some of the earliest postings by Josh documenting what was going on in the financial services profession. He's also the author of three books, including his latest, How I Invest My Money, and a regular contributor to CNBC. Josh is also the co-host of the well-known podcast, The Compound and Friends. Listen in for some great takeaways about Josh's journey within financial services and how he has used content creation along the way to grow his brand. Well, I am so excited today to have Josh Brown, co-founder and CEO of Ritholtz Wealth Management, with us today. I'm really excited to share this conversation with everybody. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry. I appreciate it.
I'm sure a lot of people know about you, know of you from your appearances on CNBC and in the media, but can you share a little bit about your background, about Josh Brown, who you are, kind of your path leading up to your career in financial services?
Larry, I am a failed stockbroker who figured out during the financial crisis that everything I had been doing for the 10 years prior was A, not helping my clients, and B, not doing anything for my own career. So I had this epiphany at the bottom, and I realized I needed to change my profession and figure out a way that I could help clients in order to help myself. So that's just what I did. I met my partner, Barry Ritholtz, through financial blogging, and the two of us hit it off and decided we should work together. I went and joined the RIA that he was working at the time, and started talking to Barry Ritholtz fans, and gradually built the following of my own. And within a couple of years, it became apparent that Barry and I should start our own firm. So we met two other gentlemen, Michael Batnick and Chris Venn. Michael became our director of research. Chris became our director of financial planning. And the four of us, Wizard of Oz-like, stumbled down the yellow brick road until we found the Emerald City and built this thing that started with about $60 million in AUM in September of 2013. Our newest Form ADV filing actually comes out next week. It will indicate we're closer to $4.3 billion, and we're about 65 employees now in, I think, 15 different cities, organically growing at one of the fastest rates in America.
Amazing. It even surprises me that stockbrokers are still around. It amazes me.
I mean, they're not. There are not many. There are not many. But I am happy to say that I am not one of them.
Yeah, you and me both. Actually, I was at a networking function the other day and they had like this icebreaker question. And it was like, what was your first job and what did you learn from it? And I literally said to them, I was like, did you see The Wolf of Wall Street? And they said, yes. I was like, that's exactly the type of firm I started out at. What I learned from that was not where I wanted to be. And that was not how you help people.
That's why you're smarter than me. You saw the writing on the wall. It took me, I don't know, 12 years. Now, a lot of the things that I learned there turned out to be really beneficial. It just took a while to figure that out. But I think I learned how to sell, which a lot of people take for granted, or they look at it as like not that important. It's hugely important. Everyone in this world is selling something. I think I learned how to take rejection, because you would make 500 phone calls a day and 490 of them did not go well. And most importantly, from an investment perspective, I learned everything not to do with your money. I had a front row seat for the dumbest things that like you could imagine for years and years and years. So I might make new mistakes, but I don't make those mistakes. And I don't let other people make those mistakes. At the time, it didn't feel great to be living that life and failing year after year. But now I can look back and say that was a really unique life experience to have had. And I think it's probably helping me more than it's hurting me these days.
Sure. I agree. So listen, I'm going to jump right in with what actually prompted me to reach out to you. Can you tell us, I know you have your first movie coming up here. This is not financial advice. Can you tell us about that? What that's all about?
So I have a very small role in that, but there was a group of documentary filmmakers who were fortunate enough during the pandemic to have followed around some really interesting people. None of them professionals. They were all retail traders, many of whom were trading for the first time, just really because markets were going crazy and there was not much else to do. And they happened to have hit upon some trading activity that made them overnight millionaires. And then in most cases, cost them everything, including in one case, a marriage. So it's this really wild roller coaster story of the ups and downs of Bitcoin and SPACs and the NASDAQ and Dogecoin. And it's hard to say it better than it's like an encapsulation of the fear and greed and like the whole behavioral experience of instant riches and then losses and the roller coaster. So I am like one of the commentators along with Morgan Housel and several other well-known financial market commentators. And we just basically narrate the story while the movie captures the real life story of the people who are caught up in it.
And just in case our listeners are looking for that, where and when is that coming out? When is that going to be available and where?
It's actually out now. You can buy it on Amazon or Apple, and then it's available on several smaller streaming services. I guess depending on whenever this comes out, I'm not sure where it will be. But if you look up, This Is Not Financial Advice, you will find us.
Yeah. So let's go back a little bit. Just over a decade ago, as you mentioned, you transitioned and evolved from a commission-based broker to a fee-based financial advisor. And I think many in the public still don't understand what that difference is and what it means to them and what that's all about. What prompted that transition for you? What was really the impetus there? I know you tapped on a little bit of it, but really, what was the game plan there? And what does it mean for the public in terms of the difference between those commission-based and fee-based advisors? What does it mean to them?
So in the late 2000s, there was basically two types of people calling themselves financial advisors. One type were mostly independent, mostly in the RIA channel, fee-only fiduciary advisors, many of whom were practicing financial planning and then doing asset management that was being informed by the needs of the plan. And that, to me, at that time, looked like it was the right thing to be doing. And I think most people understood that it was. And I ended up writing a book about it that came out in 2012, but I basically predicted the entire industry is going to shift from commission-based transactional business model to that fee-based fiduciary standard. which has happened. Not fully, but directionally, that's where we are.
Far along that curve, for sure.
Yeah, so in 2010, there was a survey, and they asked millionaires, so fairly sophisticated people, what's the difference between a financial advisor and a stockbroker? Or actually, the way they phrased it was they asked people if their stockbroker had a fiduciary responsibility to them. And 93% of those people said yes. And of course, the answer is no. So I think that by and large, to your point, the investing public did not understand that there were people who were transacting with customers and not serving as a fiduciary the way that, let's say, a doctor owes you a certain duty of care, that they should be doing things that are for your health. An attorney that you hire owes you a degree of loyalty and is there only to serve you. Stockbrokers are being paid by third parties. So you had conflicted salespeople who were being paid by mutual fund companies, but being paid by IPO syndicates, being paid by all different kinds of platforms and investment bankers in order to sell you products. And you thought that they were in some way loyal to you only. And that just was not the case. So that was the distinction. And ultimately, as I said, the industry moved away from transactions for the most part. I know with insurance, there are still transactions, and that's okay. I understand that. But if you encounter a financial advisor in 2024, it's highly likely that that advisor is going to be paid only by you on a fee basis and not by any kind of third-party incentives to sell you products.
Yeah, which I think makes it much better for the investing public, at least better than the way it used to be, for sure.
It removes most of the worst conflicts. It's not perfect. Nothing is perfect, but I think the middle class who now has access to fee-based fiduciary advice in a way that just was not readily available 10 years ago, I think that's where the biggest benefit is for regular people who just want advice. They don't want to be raked over the coals. Now there are a lot of people ready and willing to serve them.
Yeah, agreed. And one of the things that you did during this transition was you really started putting yourself out there in 2009 by becoming the reform broker on Twitter. What did those early days look like? What was your goal by putting out that content? I think it was so forward thinking because most advisors today are not on Twitter. The vast majority of them aren't. And I could probably say with relative certainty, very few, a fraction of who are on today were on that early in 2009. So what was the driver there for you?
We invented finance Twitter, and not on purpose. It kind of happened by accident. Let me back up a little bit. I started the WordPress blog in 2008. The reason I started the WordPress blog was because my idol, Barry Ritholtz, was writing on WordPress. Prior to that, he was writing on TypePad. So if he were still writing on TypePad, I would have started a TypePad blog. I wanted to grow up and be Barry Ritholtz. He was the guy that I was reading during the financial crisis, and he seemed to be getting almost everything right. He was way ahead of the mainstream media. He was way ahead of the typical Wall Street talking head. He was talking about this very obvious thing. It seems obvious now. It was not at the time, where you had housing prices going vertical and incomes flat. And he said, this is unsustainable. Either everyone in America is about to get a 70% raise or home prices are going to get cut by 20%. And if they do, here are all the other dominoes that end up falling. That was Barry's insight. His mother was a realtor. So it was not a particularly complex insight to have, but it was very unpopular to say that the housing market could fall. It was even more unpopular to point to the connection between housing prices and the stock market. So he did those things. So I was reading that. And then one day I said, you know what? I can write. I should start a blog. So I started a WordPress blog to tell my own story. This is in 2008. Somewhere in between Lehman Brothers and Bernie Madoff, right? The fall of 08. Yeah. And when you start a WordPress blog and you go to hit publish, there are three buttons underneath where it says publish. One of those buttons has an F for Facebook. One has an IN for LinkedIn. And the third has a little blue bird. So I created a Twitter account so that when I hit the blue bird button on WordPress, it would also get released there. And then like a couple of weeks later, I logged into my Twitter account and I saw all these people commenting on these automated links that were just links to my blog. I never looked there. I was like, wow, people are like talking about my stuff here. So I started to talk, and it turned out that I had a talent for saying things in short bursts. And the talent was that I could mix information with comedy. And that does really well on Twitter to this day. So I became one of the first people working in finance to have a Twitter account. There was almost no one else there that was registered, probably because compliance departments wouldn't allow it. Larry, I was fortunate enough that I worked at a firm that was going out of business, and the compliance guy just had bigger worries.
Right.
So I said, I'm going to be on this thing called WordPress, and I'm going to be on Twitter. And he said, I've never heard of these words that you're saying, and I don't really care. I have an SEC exam going on. I have a firm running out of money. I have financial advisors trading triple leveraged ETFs for retail clients. You go do whatever the hell you want. Just make sure you print a copy and put it on my desk, and I'll sign it. So I kind of had this advantage that other FAs didn't have. So I became really influential on Twitter prior to meeting Barry, and it's probably how I ended up meeting him. So I get invited to like a blogger conference, and that's where I cross paths with Barry. So the Twitter thing was accidental. I didn't like set out to become a million follower account on Twitter. It's a combination of being early, being clever, and sticking to it and doing it for a really long time. So I quit Twitter about 4 years ago, but I had a really nice run.
That's amazing. Yeah. The blog really developed a big following. And one of your blog posts, How I Invest My Money, you basically transitioned that into a book. How did you make that transition? And what was the impetus behind the decision to say, hey, this blog post really has a lot of meat to it. I'm going to develop a book out of this.
Well, it's funny. Somewhere along the way, I became a contributor to CNBC. There was a period of time where I was on like 5 days a week. I'm on 2 or 3 days a week now. But I was ubiquitous for, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years. And every day was like, what do you think of this sector? What do you think of this stock? What do you think of the market? What do you think of the economy? Nobody ever said, like, what does your own portfolio look like? How do you invest your own money? Nobody ever asked in the media. But like regular people would be like, hey, just curious, what do you do with your money? So I wrote the blog. And it was about how not every decision that I make with my money is necessarily the spreadsheet decision. Some of the things I do because of friendships that I have, relationships that I have, investing in friends' companies, putting money into startups that are related to the industry. The point of the book was to say, like, people have reasons for doing things, including Jack Bogle, that might be off message, but are sentimentally or emotionally important to them. And that might be how much cash you hold or your decision whether or not you want to buy a house or just rent because you don't like that as an investment, et cetera. Brian Portnoy, who called me, he's a behavioral expert. You know, Brian, I know.
Yeah.
He's an author. He's a wonderful guy. And he said, dude, this is a book. We get all our friends in the industry to write about what they do with their money. And we collect those as chapters. And you and I are the editors. So I said, so I don't have any work to do? He goes, no, I'll do the editing. We're running with your concept. So you help me come up with the list of contributors and I'll do the heavy lifting on the editing side. And we'll get Carl Richards to draw pictures. And that's it. Let's do it. So we did it and it was a hit. And we sold a ton of books. And it was a lot of fun working with Brian. And it was during the pandemic. So there was really not that much else to do.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just end this by saying when the book came out, we did something really interesting. We did a virtual book tour. So I wanted to sign copies of the book the way I had for my previous two books, but you couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't meet people. This is the fall of 2000. So instead, we had people mail me the book along with a check for my local food bank, which is Long Island Cares, the Harry Chapin Food Bank. And we raised like tens of thousands of dollars for Long Island Cares at a time that it was really critical. A lot of people were messed up during the pandemic.
Sure.
We were able to like turn the fact that we couldn't meet people in person to sign books into something even better. I got to tell you, I went through a lot of Sharpies. I spent a lot of money at the post office because I mailed everyone's book back at my expense. I sent books to Israel, Canada, Europe. It was a really nice project to work on during the pandemic and try to do something good and also get autographs to the readers. So
yeah,
I don't know if I would do it again, but I'm glad I did it.
And Long Island Cares is a great organization, and they certainly needed a lot of help during that time. They have a location right down the road from us, and we've done holiday collections and dropped it off there. It's very rewarding to help them out because it's amazing that in this day and age, how many people go without just necessities like food. And it's a real issue in there.
I still work with them every year on Thanksgiving. We do these meal bags. They put out an ingredient list of what each family will need. It's like 2 cans of vegetables and, you know, it's like a whole list. And I've gotten the kids involved and they have their friends come out. And last year we collected, I think it's like 160 Thanksgiving meals.
Amazing.
All in one shot. We took over the parking lot at my kids' high school. And everyone from the community that got the word out brought at least one bag. And so in addition to raising a lot of cash, we also are donating these meal kits directly to LI Cares. And they had the truck pull up. And it's great for the kids to do that, not just because they're helping other people, but it's building their understanding of like the range of lifestyles that are out there. And there are people living a life where they depend on things like this. And my kids just haven't had that experience. I want them to be aware that that exists. And I want them to think of someone other than themselves.
We're taking a quick detour from the show to bring you a special offer. Are you tired of generic financial advice that just doesn't resonate with you? We are offering our best-selling book, Financial Planning Made Personal, for the sale price of 99 cents. This book helps you find joy in the journey while planning for your ideal tomorrow. Grab your copy on Amazon or at financialplanningmadepersonal.com before the Kindle version returns to its regular price of $7.99. Before we return to the show, I have a question for you. What did you do today that brought you joy?
Well, I think that's a great segue into what I want to talk, because one of the things that resonated for me from the book was a quote attributed to Brian Portnoy. He talked about the definition of wealth is funded contentment. Why do you think that it's so important to have investing bring you joy? What is so important there? Because I think a lot of people concentrate on the dollars and cents, right? How can this investment bring me additional money or growth on that money? But in the end, that money is really there for that funded contentment and to bring you joy. Why is that so important?
So I straddle a line between people that get a lot of enjoyment out of the recreational aspect of investing, like what companies they own and who's reporting earnings and is Apple going to out-innovate Meta this quarter? And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm fascinated by that. So that's like a big part of my career is understanding what's happening and explaining it to people and having an opinion on that. But when people come to me for help, most of the time they think that that's what they need help with. Like they'll hit our website and it's not because they're like, I mean, these are very intelligent, highly successful people, but they don't know what their question is. They think their question is like, all right, so you guys will buy the right stocks for me. And we have to jujitsu that into, well, what are we trying to do? Like for you, not is Coke better than Pepsi? We'll talk about that later. What really matters to you? And when we do that with a certified financial planner on the front end, having that initial conversation with a client, the client almost like a light bulb goes off like, oh yeah, like this is what I really need. I need somebody to tell me like, what am I doing with taxes, with insurance, with like estate? What do I want the money to do in 10 years and 20 years? So that's the funded contentment part that Brian is talking about. Did I beat the S&P? Did I trail the S&P? How much international stocks? Should I have gold? All of that stuff. Those are derivatives of the bigger question, which is why? Why are we taking risks to begin with? So I think we've done a really good job at straddling that line and talking to people on both sides of it. And that's the job. So people don't know what they need. And you have to be able to take the question that they start with and migrate it to the right questions. I think we've done that really well as a firm over the last 10 years.
Yeah, that's great stuff. And I agree with you. We were having a conversation with a family yesterday, and one of the things they asked us was, well, what are other people doing? What are other people investing in? And I'm like, well, I don't understand how other people affect you per se. I'm like, what do you want to accomplish? What do you want this money to do for you? Forget about what other people are doing. But sometimes they think that's what they should be doing, and it's tough.
It's important not to completely close off that element and make people feel as though they're foolish for caring about how the portfolio works or what's in it. I know that there are a lot of advisors whose the way that they sell themselves is to like really denigrate any kind of investing information. Like, it's Vanguard or shut up. And I guess there's a segment of the population that responds positively to that. I don't think that that's who we reach. We reach people who are interested enough in the markets that they find us in the first place. Like, if you're watching CNBC or listening to a financial podcast, you probably care somewhat
right
about the markets. So our conversation with them is not, why are you asking me a question about international small caps? What are you, an idiot? I think it's really important not to put someone down for being curious. The best thing that you could do for people is to contextualize that information and to make them understand that, yes, it does matter that Google is doing well right now and Apple isn't, and understanding the forces behind why. And it is interesting to talk about. But Larry, to your point, neither of those companies per se are going to mean the difference between somebody being able to retire comfortably or not.
Right.
Like, and making outsized bets.
It's good
bets.
Conversation. It's good conversation. And you have to meet people where they're at, right? And to some people, they want to dive a little bit deeper, and some people don't. And you have to meet them where they're at in a lot of cases.
I think that's right.
So you were instrumental in the creation of the Future Proof Festival, basically a financial, I guess, for lack of a better word, financial conference, more like a financial jamboree, I guess, that takes place over in Huntington Beach, California. What was the impetus? Why'd you create this? And what did you hope that the festival would accomplish?
So Matt Middleton at Advisor Circle had worked for Informa on an event called Inside ETFs. And very successfully, they built that into one of the biggest industry events of the year. They had come to us and said, what if we built something that was more geared directly toward financial advisors? And that was 2018. And the result of that conversation was the creation of something called Wealth Stack, which was an event that we threw only once.
I was there.
You were there. So, you know, I think that's where you and I met.
You and I flew on the same plane out there. Okay. Been introduced to you like the week before. Yeah.
So WealthStack was a huge success, but it was a microcosm of what we would eventually do. It was 700 people. It was in Scottsdale, Arizona. It was 130 degrees outside, which meant all of the sessions in the air condition were fully attended, and people had so much fun. And it was the first time that we had scratched the surface on this idea that the only real reason to have an event is the networking. It's not that you don't want to have good content and education on stage. It's that that's table stakes and people can get most of that online. So the real reason to do this is the experience and the connections that people make with each other. That's the part you can't do online. We were early to that idea because the pandemic happened a year later. And obviously WealthStack got mothballed and Matt eventually left Informa, sat out a non-compete. And then came to us with his new idea, which was, remember that thing we did with WealthStack where we really leaned into the experience and the networking?
Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
What if we did that on steroids? What if we did that 10X? And Michael Batnick and I said, you have our attention. Matt recognized that we had the ability to get people excited to try something brand new like that, and that our following would be the right cornerstone to build that experience. We recognized in Matt somebody that just understood how to do an event, the logistics, the planning, the staffing, the AV, the decor. Matt was like a genius. And I guess in our way, we had like this really special aspect with our media presence. So the combination was like lightning in a bottle. We did Future Proof 1 in 22. Future Proof 2 was last year. Future Proof 3 is going to be insanity. That'll be this September. And every year it'll get bigger. Last year it almost doubled in size. This year it will be no exception. I think we'll be 4,000 to 4,500 people. It just keeps improving. The key thing that we have to make sure we hang on to is the feeling of being there for the financial advisor remains special. And if we just lean into building that experience so people feel like they can't miss it, the festival will go on.
Awesome. Awesome. What a great way to celebrate and connect with a lot of people. And it's like the one time a year where you could see everybody and anybody that you want to connect with is there. And it's
my biggest regret is that it took place the first 2 years overlapping Carson XL. First of all, because we're huge fans of Carson Wealth and Ron and so many of your people.
Appreciate that.
So I think this coming year, we don't overlap.
You do not.
So, okay. So yeah,
looking forward to
That's great news.
Yeah, good stuff. So you talked about a couple of times, you stepped away from commission sales, you stepped away from Twitter, and this past November, you posted that it was the end of the Reform Broker blog. Can you share with me, you know, power of walking away, right? Because I think a lot of us start things, do things, and we get so involved that it's very difficult for us to walk away from those things and step into the next thing. But can you talk about the power you get from stepping away and then moving on to what is next?
Who's your favorite rock star?
I don't have one in particular, but I'm like a very multi-talented, or I like a lot of different genre of music. But
me too.
One of my favorites, if I had to pull it out, is from my hockey days, AC/DC. Love that band. That's one of the tops.
Yeah, I love AC/DC. I caught them at Madison Square Garden when Axl Rose was the lead singer. Yeah. That was one of the best concerts I've ever been to, actually.
Yeah, pretty electric, yeah.
Yeah, so AC/DC is amazing. When I think of like my favorite, not my favorite musician per se, but my favorite rock star, I think of people like David Bowie and Bob Dylan and Elton John. And what they have in common is that they had hit songs in multiple decades and they had hit albums. So a lot of rock stars, like they have this period of time from when they're 20 to when they're 28. It's something weird where like that's their highest output years. And then whatever that magical quality is, it like goes away or the public loses interest. But the reason why that doesn't happen always, and you have people like Bowie who break the mold, is because they evolve. If you think about Taylor Swift, what was the Eras Tour about? I think she started at 16 years old. So she already has, she's been a star during three different decades already, or all of two decades. What 2020s, the 2010s, in the 2000s.
Well, you've become famous overnight, no? Everybody takes off overnight, no?
Well, but the point is, she starts out as a country star. She moves into this other phase where she's almost like one of these teen singing sensations and goes pop. And then it continues to evolve. And every era of Taylor Swift's career is a different album and a different persona. David Bowie did that. Way before Taylor Swift was born, he had his Aladdin Sane era. He had his Ziggy Stardust era. The music would change and his persona would change and the clothing and the style. And that's how he kept current, because he doesn't look like or sound like the version of him from the late 60s. Okay. So evolving is really important, because if you don't evolve, then you get stuck and pinned into a certain era. And then you're yesterday's news. So I always said, like, there comes a time when something runs its course and you should stop and you should do something new. I've always been able to do that over the last 15 years. I've been able to let go of things that I used to do and I no longer want to do. In my earliest days, I was writing columns for the Wall Street Journal and Forbes. But then I looked around and everyone else was doing that too. And I said, well, then I'm not doing this anymore. So these things run their course, and the easiest thing in the world is to just keep going, because you're like trying to live in the glory of 5 years ago, or you're trying to hold on to something that you have. It's much harder to retire something and start something brand new and start over. But I've done that, and I've walked away from things that I became very associated with, like Twitter, And I've never regretted. I've never said, I wish I was back doing that. Right. So it gets easier.
Is YouTube the new Josh Brown era then? Is that your new media?
Yeah. YouTube is the present and the future. And I can't believe no one else is investing in that the way that I am. Not in money, but in time and yeah. quality.
Yeah, I just watched that Compound episode a week or so ago with Ryan Dietrich from our team, and that was awesome. I didn't realize
so much fun. Involved.
Yeah, it was great. I saw the one with Eli Manning. I think that was this week, which again, great guests, great content, and super
Thank
long
you.
Form. It's really good. So that's the shift for Josh Brown. You're really leaning into YouTube now.
Yeah. So you have a teenager. I have two teenagers. They will never turn on cable news.
No.
Like, it's not ever going to happen. So
if it didn't happen on Snapchat or Instagram, Josh, it didn't really happen.
It's right. So my daughter will open Netflix. My daughter will watch YouTube on her TV, but she doesn't even have a remote for the cable box, the Verizon Fios. The remote is like in her drawer. So I say to her, did you watch Saturday Night Live this week? She saw the clips of it on YouTube. She didn't watch it linearly or even on DVR on NBC. She wouldn't even know what channel to press to get NBC, but she could tell me every skit that happened on SNL. So this is the world now. And to fight it or to pretend it doesn't exist, again, that's like playing your one hit song from 1989 for the next 10 years. So that's the evolution and that's where things are going. And if you want to talk to investors for the next 10 years who are coming into their peak earnings years, there's a higher likelihood that they will discover you on YouTube than they will on any other platform, social media network, or channel you could possibly be contributing to. So we figured that out. I can't believe no one else has. We basically have it to ourselves. Our moat is growing deeper and wider. We have 6 full-time employees fully dedicated to creating podcasts and YouTube content, and we'll have more by the end of this year. The show has gotten huge, and one of the reasons the show is so successful is because people like Ryan, when they go on TV, they get 30 seconds.
Right.
You come to me, you get an hour and 30 minutes. Not everyone's worthy of an hour and 30 minutes, but Ryan certainly is. That's how the audience wants to get their content now. They want to put the AirPods in, get on the bike, and listen to Larry Sprung for 40 minutes while they do their workout. They Damn. Don't want to sit on the couch and watch television.
Same with The Compound and Friends. Great show. So listen, I've had a tremendous amount of joy from our conversation, and we're all about joy on the Mintland Money Mindset. And we ask each of our guests the same last question, which is, what did you do today that brought you joy and put you in the right mindset for success?
Bacon, egg, and cheese on an onion bagel, toasted onion bagel.
All right. That sounds fantastic. I think I have to get one tomorrow.
Besides that, hanging with people like yourself who get it, who are client focused, who are serious about building your practice, building your firm, like, this is a joyful event for me for sure. So it's been an honor and a pleasure to be on the show.
Thanks, Josh. It's been my pleasure as well. And if people want to find you, learn more about you, I know you're out there. What's the easiest and the best way for them to do that? And we'll have all of your information in the show notes, of course.
Totally. Go to The Compound channel on YouTube. Follow me on LinkedIn. My new website is Downtown Josh Brown, which is built on Beehive architecture. And it's really simple. You put your email address in the box, and every time I write something, you will be the first to know. So that's the best way to follow me.
Awesome. Well, listen, Josh, I thank you for taking the time out for joining us today, and enjoy the day.
Thank you so much, Larry.
I want to thank Josh Brown for being a guest on the Mintland Money Mindset. Josh was an early adopter of technology to help tell his story. His foresight to document his journey through his blog, The Reform Broker, was first followed by thousands and then millions. Josh started opening advisors and the public's eyes to the benefits of the advisory model versus the broker model, which was the most common for a long time. His blog began at a time where the profession was beginning to make a seismic shift. Josh used his blog to become a thought leader in the profession, and today his content creation is often recognized as some of the best out there. Josh Brown and all that he is up to can be found across most social media platforms. All of the contact information needed to find him can be found in the show notes. Thank you for joining us this week on the Mintland Money Mindset. Make sure you visit our website at MintlandMoneyMindset.com and smash the subscribe button so you don't miss a show. We encourage you to help others find our valuable content, and please don't keep us a secret. You can also schedule an Is There a Fit call right from our website or by using the link that you'll find in the description section of your podcast player or app. And be sure to join us for our next episode to learn more about getting your mind right when it comes to all things money.
The opinions voiced in the Mittlin Money Mindset Show with Lawrence Sprung are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. No strategy ensures success or protects against loss. To determine what may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial or tax advisor prior to investing. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Guests on the Mittlin Money Mindset Show are not affiliated with CWM LLC.